Welcome back to another deep dive. I'm your host, ready to get into a really unexpected topic today.
And I am your resident expert. And honestly, I am still trying to wrap my head around this one.
Right. Yeah. So imagine receiving this highly guarded, incredibly dense stack of documents from a secretive organization known as the Brizart Research Archive.
You open the file, right?
Exactly. You open it expecting to uncover the literal, I don't know, mechanical architecture of the human mind. You're looking for mind-bending theories about how we form our identity or how we perceive time through these recursive psychological loops.
You're basically looking for the profound secrets of human consciousness.
Yes. But instead, staring back at you is a $50,000 PDF document template.
It's a jarring pivot, to say the least. You go in searching for the soul and you find a style guide.
A style guide that has essentially been weaponized. And that is exactly what we are focusing on today. For you, the listener, who we always love to call the learner, you send us this massive stack of research from the Brizart Archive.
Which, thank you for that, by the way. Incredible stuff.
Oh, absolutely. But while the theories inside are fascinating, our mission for this deep dive is to focus on the container holding those ideas. We are exploring the Brizart format. Version 2.1.
Right.
And we are going to unpack how a simple document template, which was designed for pure scientific clarity, doubles as an incredibly aggressive legal trap holding modern academic labs hostage. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, to grasp the gravity of a formatting template becoming, you know, a literal legal trap, we first have to understand the specific mechanical problem this format was engineered to solve.
Which is what, exactly?
Well, in the documents, the Brizart format version 2.1 is defined as a standardized archival-grade publication structure.
Okay.
The creator, an independent researcher named Jason Brizart, built it to guarantee that every single cognitive framework he releases is clear, reproducible, and seamlessly integrates into a much larger scientific ecosystem.
Right. So taking a step back, this means the format itself isn't a theory of mind.
Exactly.
It is the meta layer.
That is a crucial distinction. The format is not a cognitive mechanism. It is the structural vessel that preserves the mechanisms.
Got it.
When Brizart releases a new theoretical model on a public repository like Zenodo, he doesn't just write up like a standard essay detailing his findings. He filters his thoughts through this exact format every single time.
You know, the sources use a fantastic analogy that makes this instantly clear.
Oh, the library one.
Yeah, yeah. If the Brizart Research Archive is a massive library and the complex cognitive theories like perceptual framing theory or the temporal feedback loop are the individual books, then the Brizart format is the binding.
Right.
It's the binding, the layout, and the underlying cataloging system that keeps the entire library from devolving into total chaos.
It's a very apt way to visualize the architecture. And architecture really is the operative word here, because this format dictates a strict modular and repeatable structure. Every single framework released in this format must contain 7 specific unalterable elements.
Unalterable. Wow. I am looking at the sequence right now and it is incredibly demanding.
Oh, it really is.
It starts with a clear conceptual overview, which, you know, seems normal enough. But then step 2 requires a formal mathematical or symbolic definition of the framework.
Which weeds out a lot of vague philosophy right there.
Right. And then step 3 demands a detailed breakdown of the internal mechanisms. Step 4 forces the author to map the framework's specific role within the larger system of the mind.
Yeah, so it forces the author to contextualize their work immediately. You cannot just introduce a concept in total isolation.
You have to explain the gears.
Exactly. You explain the gears, and then you have to explain which machine those gears belong to.
Then we get to step 5, which mandates testable empirical predictions. Step 6 requires implementation agnostic diagrams or schemas.
Yeah, I mean, highly specific.
Right. And finally, step 7 demands strict licensing and archival metadata. If I am a researcher writing about, say, human willpower, this format physically prevents me from just philosophizing for 20 pages.
Right.
I have to provide the math, the mechanics, and the testable data in a highly specific sequence.
What's fascinating here is how this strict structure solves a major historical bottleneck in academia.
How so?
Well, usually reading dense abstract theories about human consciousness is a brutal slog. I mean, you wade through paragraphs of nuanced philosophical text trying to locate the actual testable hypothesis.
Tell me about it. It takes hours.
Exactly. But by forcing the data into this 7-step sequence, the Brizart format makes these massive abstract concepts immediately understandable and instantly comparable.
I mean, I understand the elegance of that standardization. But I have to push back here, because this sounds like an enormous amount of overhead for a scientist just trying to share a discovery.
It does seem like a lot up front.
Wait, aren't scientists already good at formatting paper? I mean, we already have APA-style, MLA, Chicago. We have standard peer-reviewed journal structures that have worked for over a century. Why invent a completely new, incredibly rigid template?
That's a fair question.
Forcing every brilliant idea into the exact same 7-step box seems like a creative straitjacket.
It absolutely functions as a straitjacket, until you look at the sheer, staggering complexity of Brizard's models. We are not dealing with isolated, standalone psychological studies here.
Right, they're big.
They're deeply intertwined. Take perceptual framing theory, or PFT, which constructs the moment-to-moment snapshot of reality. Then you have the temporal feedback loop, TFL.
Which stitches those individual moments together across time.
Exactly. Or the intent resolution engine, IRE, which governs how human willpower actuates within those stitched moments.
So none of these theories work on their own. They are interlocking pieces of a single massive engine of human consciousness.
Yes. And because they interlock, they must speak the exact same structural language. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the Brizard format isn't just a style guide. It is an interoperability engine.
Okay, an interoperability engine. Let's ground that for a second. Mm-hmm. How does that actually change the experience for a researcher sitting at their desk reading one of these papers?
Let's look at the mathematics of a perceptual frame. In the PFT documentation, a frame is defined mathematically as F equals a tuple of P, M, A, and I.
Right.
Those letters stand for perceptual anchors, memory, affective tone, and interpretive structure.
That is a lot of dense variables to track just to understand a single moment of perception.
It really is. But because this equation is written in the Brizard format, the researcher reading it doesn't have to scour the entire document to understand how the affective tone is measured.
Oh, because they already know where it is.
Exactly. The format dictates a specific proprietary schema for integrating empirical data. The researcher instantly knows exactly where to look on the page to find the testable predictions for that specific variable.
Wow.
They know exactly which section will explain how that perceptual frame syncs up with external social identity models like SST. The format turns what would normally be a chaotic collection of disjointed academic papers into a unified scientific project.
It's similar to standardizing the shape of a shipping container.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah, think about it. Before standardization, moving cargo was chaotic. You had barrels, sacks, crates of all different sizes, and loading a ship took weeks.
A total logistical nightmare.
Right. But once every container is the exact same size and shape, you can build cranes, ships, and trucks specifically designed to move them. It revolutionized the entire global supply chain because everyone agreed on the exact dimensions of the box.
And Brizard standardized the dimensions of the theoretical box. By doing so, he allowed researchers to build computational cranes and trucks, you know, supercomputer models and clinical trials that can seamlessly load and unload these cognitive theories.
The scientific efficiency of that is undeniably brilliant, but the efficiency is what creates the danger.
Yeah, it is.
Because if this format is the only way to effectively move these massive cognitive theories around, then whoever controls the shipping container controls the entire global supply chain of thought.
Which brings us to the academic research license agreement.
Here's where it gets really interesting. This is where the narrative shifts from scientific elegance to a highly aggressive corporate strategy.
Right.
So Brizard releases pieces of his grand theory to the public on open access sites to build hype. The scientific community sees the math, they see the brilliance of the interoperability, and top-tier labs realize they desperately need these tools to stay competitive.
They want the cranes.
Exactly. Mm. But to actually run these frameworks in their supercomputers or apply them to their own clinical data, the labs have to sign this license agreement. And that agreement comes with a flat, non-refundable fee of $50,000 a year.
Now, in the context of large-scale university research, $50,000 is often viewed as a bargain for access to what is essentially a turnkey theoretical division.
50 grand for a whole paradigm shift. Yeah, that's cheap.
Right. But the financial cost is merely the entry fee. The true cost is buried in the fine print, specifically Section 3 of that contract.
Section 3 is the trap. This is where Brizard turns his highly efficient interoperability engine into a terrifying legal weapon.
Yeah. When a university signs that contract, they explicitly agree that the Brizard format itself is protected intellectual property.
Which is wild.
As you mentioned earlier, this is not about copywriting double space Times New Roman or a specific margin size. The format contains proprietary formatting logic. It contains specific sequences of sections. It features highly specific placeholder schemas designed for integrating empirical data with theoretical claims.
Wait, let me make sure I'm grasping the scale of this. Brizard didn't just copyright the words detailing his theory of consciousness. He copyrighted the empty spaces where the words are supposed to go.
Yes.
He copyrighted the structural sequence of how an argument is built on the page.
He copyrighted the architecture of the argument, the very flow of logic from conceptual overview down to empirical placeholder schemas is treated as sensitive, proprietary intellectual property.
Okay, we need to trace the psychological reality of a postdoc researcher caught in this trap, because the sources detail a scenario that shows how this plays out for actual human beings working in these labs.
Yes, the muscle memory scenario.
Yeah. Let's look at that.
So consider a top-tier university lab that pays the $50,000 fee. They gain access to the archive, and they put a team of brilliant postdocs to work.
Right, and these postdocs spend an entire year immersed in the Brizard Research Archive. They're reading the materials, designing experiments, and every single day, they're required to write up their own findings using the highly efficient Brizard format.
They have to use the 7 structural elements.
Yep. They use the proprietary placeholder schemas to log their data. They map their variables using the exact sequence dictated by the template.
And after 12 months of 60-hour work weeks, utilizing this format is no longer just a laboratory rule.
It becomes physical and mental muscle memory.
Exactly.
Their brains literally rewire to organize scientific thought in this specific sequence. You don't even think about it anymore. Your brain just naturally defaults to, you know, conceptual overview, mathematical definition, internal mechanisms. It is how you formulate a hypothesis.
It becomes their default mode of professional communication.
Mm-hmm.
Now, consider what happens when the university faces a budget cut.
The funding dries up.
Yeah. The lab can't afford the $50,000 renewal fee for the next year.
Yeah.
Their license to the Brizard Archive expires, and their access to the materials is legally revoked.
Ouch.
6 months pass. One of those postdocs is now working on a completely unrelated project. Let's say they're writing a paper about auditory processing in mice.
Mice. Okay.
Right. It has absolutely nothing to do with Jason Brizard, nothing to do with perceptual framing theory, and nothing to do with human consciousness.
But they sit down at their laptop to draft the manuscript about the mice. And because they spent the last year working 80 hours a week in the Brizard Gecko system, they just instinctively type out their thoughts using the Brizard formatting logic.
Exactly.
They organize the paper using the same 7-step sequence, the same conceptual overview structure, the same proprietary placeholder schemas for their empirical data. They're just trying to write clearly using the tools their brain is accustomed to.
And that innocent action, performed out of pure habit on a completely unrelated topic, triggers a massive breach of contract.
Wait, seriously? Because they are utilizing proprietary formatting logic without an active license?
Yes. The agreement explicitly states that the university must immediately cease using the format for any new projects the very second the license expires.
Wow.
They cannot adapt the format. They cannot share it as an internal writing guide for their graduate students. They cannot legally use its logic to organize their own independent thoughts, even on topics completely divorced from Brizard's work.
The level of control there is staggering. I mean, a university general counsel literally has to police their own scientists to make sure they aren't accidentally structuring their paragraphs in a copyrighted sequence.
It's wild to think about.
The archive is legally policing how scientists organize their thoughts on a page.
It speaks to a deep systemic strategy by the Brizard Research Archives to exert total environmental control. They are not satisfied with merely owning the ideas themselves. You know, the theories of consciousness or the mathematics of intention.
Right.
They are systematically asserting legal ownership over the infrastructure of scientific communication.
It's akin to selling someone a brand new, highly efficient language. It helps them communicate faster and better than ever before. But the moment they stop paying their monthly subscription fee, you sue them for using your grammar to write a grocery list.
That is a very accurate framing. And the true insidious nature of the trap is that the format genuinely works. It actually does make complex scientific communication easier and more interoperable.
Researchers want to use it.
Exactly. They get used to the efficiency of the shipping container. But the moment they stop paying the toll, the shape of that container becomes a massive legal liability.
So what does this all mean? We started this journey looking for grand revelations about human consciousness, and we ended up in the weeds of a restrictive licensing agreement for a document template.
Quite the detour.
It really is. For you, the learner, navigating this dense stack of documents, the core takeaway here isn't the math of the temporal feedback loop or the mechanics of human willpower.
No, the central insight is about the vessels that hold our knowledge. We often assume that formatting is a neutral, stylistic choice, something you do at the very end of the writing process to make the paper look neat.
Right, like picking a font.
Exactly. But the Brizard format, version 2.1, is living proof that when structure becomes proprietary, it transforms into a mechanism of control.
The structure of information, how it is organized, how it is logically sequenced, and how it is visually presented, can be just as powerful and just as legally dangerous as the knowledge itself.
It forces us to recognize that the tools we use to frame our thinking can ultimately capture our thinking.
And that leads to a final provocative thought we want to leave you with, something for you to mull over that extends far beyond the realm of academic papers. We are currently watching the rapid explosion of artificial intelligence, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Where we interact with neural networks through complex prompts and structured thought chains. Now, if a private entity like the Brizard Archive can successfully copyright the exact structural sequence of a scientific hypothesis, what happens when a tech company patents the structural format of a highly effective AI prompt? Could we face a future where the actual sequence of human-machine interaction, the way we formulate questions to an intelligence, is locked behind a structural paywall?
A chilling possibility. The architecture of thought itself becoming a leased commodity?
Exactly. We might find our ability to innovate bottlenecked not by a lack of brilliant ideas, but by the legal ownership of the cognitive frameworks we use to express them. The container really is just as vital as the treasure inside.
It really makes you think twice about how you organize your notes.
It does. Keep that in mind the next time you open a blank document template and start organizing your thoughts. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.